Hey bosses, before we kick off this week's episode, I want to take a second to tell you about our sponsor, Masterworks.io. Masterworks is the only platform to trade blue chip art. You can buy pieces in works from artists like Banksy, Cause, Monet, so much more. In fact, works like these have outperformed the S&P by 180% from 2000 to 2018. If you want to get in on this investment, you can head over to masterworks.io where they have a waiting list. But because you are an Invest Like a Boss listener, you don't have to wait in that list. In fact, it's over 20,000 people, but we're going to skip you right to the front. Just use code ILAB at sign up. So go to masterworks.io, use code ILAB, and you'll skip right to the front of the line. I'll tell you more about Masterworks after the break. Until then, let's get the show started.
Welcome to the Invest Like a Boss podcast.
I'm Sam Marks.
And I'm Johnny FD. We're self-made entrepreneurs who invest our own money and use modern technology to invest like a boss.
Join us each week for exclusive interviews with our network of modern investors, business owners, and multimillionaires to discover new ways to invest our hard-earned cash.
Hey bosses, this is Johnny and welcome to episode 163 of the Invest Like a Boss podcast. I'm here in Sri Lanka. Sorry about the gardeners sweeping in the background, but Derek, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Johnny. It's kind of like that, what's that called, the ASMR? It's kind of relaxing. I like
it. Yeah, okay. Maybe I should just put the microphone right next to their brooms. They're using these really kind of old traditional brooms. Yeah, they're cool. I like it.
They sound really loud, like the old witches type brooms.
Yeah, that's what they look like, exactly. Like they're literally made of that out of the material.
Super fun times. not too much more exciting going on over here. I'm still in LA and we are on total lockdown. We can't really do anything. Can't even eat outside. Everyone's supposed to stay home, but you know, they're not really following that.
You know, what's funny is my girlfriend predicted that back in like July or August. She said, well, you know, she's like, watch, you know, right now during the summer, the governments aren't going to be able to control people or force them to stay inside. So they're going to just let people, you know, go out and kind of relax things. But as soon as winter hits, December 1st, they're going to lock everything down. And I thought she was crazy. I thought like no way, that doesn't make any sense. But she was right. You know, the Ukrainians know about government lockdown. So
I guess if anyone would know, the Eastern Bloc would definitely know.
Yeah. So I'm staying at a beautiful pool villa here in South Sri Lanka. The weather is amazing and we're able to go out and, you know, they're not officially allowed to have big gatherings, but, you know, we've been going to bars and restaurants with like, you know, 20, 30 people hanging out and everything's good.
I know we can't see each other right now, but the look on my face is a lot of envy.
Sorry to hear that, buddy. But I am not staying in Airbnb. We'll talk about that more in the outro, but I hated Amazon for years now, and I hated Airbnb for years now. But at the same time, I realized that just because I hate them, it doesn't mean they're not going to do well. And I've been completely wrong, you know, kind of for very similar reasons. And we'll get to that in the outro on why I personally don't like their business models for kind of the greater good of the customer. But I can see them both doing so well. And Amazon obviously has done so well. And now we have Airbnb about to IPO.
Yeah, I think you are very much in the minority there, Johnny. We decided to do this episode because a lot of people in the Boss Lounge, you can check us out as a Facebook group. If you want to join, go to investlikeaboss.com. You can find out how to do that. A lot of people were talking about it in there. And I just started seeing articles come up all over the place. There's these huge IPOs. And I mean, there's none really any bigger right now than Airbnb. Everybody knows it. It's a huge brand name. They have over 7 million properties on their website and they don't own one of them, not even one. So it's an amazing business model of what they've been able to do. And I'm surprised they haven't gone public already. So this should be an exciting time. As of recording this, next week is their official IPO date. So we decided to get on someone to talk about it. His name's Tom Tolley. He's a writer for Forbes.com and he specializes in IPOs and startups.
Yeah, I think a lot of investors in the Boss Lounge are curious about this. They're interested. You know, most people have stayed in an Airbnb before. You know, everybody's heard of Airbnb. In fact, it's even hard to say, you know, I stayed, you know, like you'll say, you know, I stayed in a hotel, or you'll say I stayed in Airbnb, even if it was a private rental, even if you got it from VRBO or somewhere else. Airbnb has become the term, like making a Xerox or grabbing a Kleenex.
Totally. Or I grabbed an Uber, which I could be in a Lyft. I've been in Ubers. I've been in Lyfts, and I said, I got an Uber, and the driver gets offended. I'm in a Lyft. I'm like, well, you know what I mean.
So I'm excited to kind of hear more about the process itself, because I think a lot of people, including myself, have never actually invested in an IPO. We've always assumed it's something for the kind of elite money managers, and us as retail investors or individual investors just don't have access to it. So I am curious to hear more about that process.
Yeah, so we're going to touch on how the actual IPO process works and the ins and outs of the Airbnb business model. So let's see what Tom Tolley has to say about all of that in the interview. Froth. It's great on top of your pumpkin spice latte, not so great in your investment portfolio. If you've been watching the stock market lately, there's enough froth to fill up a stadium of venti lattes. S&P trading at 37 times earnings. The top five tech stocks are up over 50% this year, but the rest of the index only up about 5%. So not the greatest if you're looking for diversity. Bonds, those aren't doing much better either. Most of the bonds, in fact, 97%, yield less than 5%. And the average savings account, well, you're lucky if you get 0.5%. So how do you avoid the froth while preserving your net wealth? You should look into art. The art market is projected to grow from $1.7 trillion to $2.6 trillion. That's trillion with a T. The ultra wealthy continue to invest in art to preserve their wealth and earn attractive returns. But unless you have an extra $10 million laying around to buy one of these paintings, you've been out of luck. Until now. Masterworks.io is the only platform that lets you invest in art. They have artists like Banksy, Kaz, Monet, and so much more. Masterworks.io is making investing in art as easy as buying stocks online. Just recently, Masterworks.io sold their first Banksy for a 32% return. It was almost double the S&P over that same time period. With the Fed injecting money into the economy at a staggering rate, sophisticated investors are allocating a portion of their portfolio to hard money assets like art to hedge against this inflation. Due to recent demand, the waitlist to invest on Masterworks.io is over 20,000 people. But since you listen to us here at Invest Like a Boss, you can skip that waitlist and go to Masterworks.io and enter promo code ILAB. That's ILAB. So go to Masterworks.io, code ILAB, and you can get signed up right now. Get to the front of that list. See important information at masterworks.io/disclaimer. It's one of the hottest IPOs of 2020, and maybe even in multiple years. Everyone's talking about this, and I know our listeners are very excited about it. It's the Airbnb IPO. We decided to get on someone who's taken a deep dive into the company. His name is Tom Tolley. Welcome to Invest Like a Boss.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, definitely. Now, you wrote an article recently, I think in Kiplinger, correct?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
We'll leave the link to that in the show notes if any of the bosses want to check it out. First of all, just why don't you tell us about yourself and how you got into this world of, you know, startups and IPOs?
Yeah, well, I'm old, so I've been in this business for a long time. I started in the computer business when I was, 12 years old when I started programming computers, and I actually started coding and sold some of the software when I was in high school. And then I just fell in love with it. Just a passion of mine. So I started a company when I was in college because when I was in college, I saw students bring laptops into the classroom. And I thought, well, maybe I should sell something to students. And I was not that great taking standardized exams. So I created software for e-learning software. It wasn't called that at the time, but software to help students pass exams. And then the internet came around, and then we went onto the internet. It wasn't called cloud at the time, but we did cloud. And then my partner really took over that business, headed that business, and I went in and created another business in 1997 called Hypermart.net. And that was my biggest thing. And it was a place you could go to create your own website, like GeoCities at the time. Sure. So, or think of it like Shopify, a 1997 version of Shopify.
Hey, I'm old enough to remember GeoCities.
Okay. And you're from the LA area, and I used to know those guys, and they were from LA too. The Globe was another of one of those players too. And it just went crazy, and we sold the company. And since then, I've been an investor in different companies. But I also, during the 90s, you know, I couldn't help but fall in love with IPOs as well. And so I created this other company in 1995 called WebIPO. And what we were about is, basically we thought we were going to sell IPOs over the internet. You know, how naive we were that we thought we could just do this, you know, out of our garage, not realizing there's something called the Securities and Exchange Commission, and there's security, you know, broker dealer laws, and we had no idea how that even existed. So
that's something we worry about later.
That's exactly. So, you know, we're true entrepreneurs, and we just were crazy. But we realized that at a certain point we were getting a lot of inbound interest. And so we sold that company. But when I was building that company, I used to write articles about upcoming IPOs, Yahoo, Netscape, Amazon, and so forth. And then when I sold it, I went off to something else, but someone at Forbes contacted me and said, you know, would you be interested in like writing for us? And I said, sure. So I started writing IPOs for Forbes.com. That's how I got involved in there. So that was probably the 1996 or seven. And then Bloomberg came to me and said, you know, we want to write someone to write a book for us on IPOs. Seems like you're into this. Would you be interested? And I said, sure. And so I wrote a book on IPOs. And so, you know, my interest in IPOs goes a long way back to the 90s, and I've just kind of kept up with it. The book has gone through, I think, three editions. You know, the first edition did really well. The second edition was disaster because it was published like right after the dot-com bust. And then the third edition came out with Facebook. So it's a feast and famine type business, IPOs. So investors, if this is a first time for you about IPOs, take it from someone who's been around the block a couple times. It can get ugly. So
exactly. I think we're definitely in a feast mode right now.
But, exactly. Famine's
always right around the corner.
Exactly.
So for some of our listeners that maybe aren't familiar with buying IPOs or don't have a lot of experience in it, can you just go over quickly what separates it from buying an already established stock, and how is it different? Mm-hmm. How is it more volatile? What are some of the kind of things to look out for and not get caught up in the hype of, oh my God, it's Airbnb, I have to buy it just because I've used it and I need it.
Good questions. It's basically like buying any other stock. You know, you can go to E-Trade, open an account, and once the stock starts trading, you just buy it. So there's nothing in terms of difference in the mechanics. Now, which you will typically see with a hot IPO is on the first day it spikes.
Sure.
And there's just a lot of demand, a lot of buzz. And we've seen this quite a bit this year with IPOs. It's not always that way, but typically the underwriter, and that's the Wall Street firm that packages these deals, will underprice the deal to encourage investors to come into it, and you'll see a big spike. And Snowflake was an example where it could be over 100% in one day.
Right. I'm going to bring that up in a second. One of our Patreons had actually mentioned the Snowflake IPO. So.
And I thought I'd wear my Snowflake shirt as well here. So,
I didn't even notice.
I've known the CEO, Frank Slootman, for about 15 years. So got pretty familiar with Snowflake. So usually the dynamics is you see a big pop in the first day. And then maybe about 40 days later, you see analysts come out, and then they will put buy recommendations. You may see another pop after that. And then you'll have the earnings report, which may come within a month or two after that. And, you know, you may see another pop after that. usually when you go IPO, you want to make sure your first quarter is a good quarter. So there's a lot of pressure to make that happen.
For sure.
So there's quite a bit of a momentum, you know, after the first day. Of the IPO, but there's all these different technical aspects of IPO. There's something called the lockup period.
I was just going to ask that. I think there's one more section where it could pop is when that lockup expires. Correct?
Well, it could go down. So the reverse.
Pop up or down.
It'll pop, usually pops down. So the lockup means that the insiders, the executives, employees, the directors, investors can start selling their shares into the open market. And then so after you've seen these big moves in the stock, it gets tempting to want to sell the shares.
Sure.
And then that might be an opportunity to pick up some shares after the lockup. Doesn't always happen, but sometimes it happens. Sometimes it goes up too. So it just depends. But those are kind of the dynamics, the trading dynamics. But after the lockup, it trades like pretty much any other stock. It's seasoned into the market. But usually those first 6 to 9 months can be pretty volatile. And if you're a trader, it's usually a playground. If you're a long-term investor that is a little skittish, it may be something you may want to hold off on.
For sure. I know a lot of our Invest Like a Boss listeners, love the risk and love the game of it. So I think IPOs are definitely a good fit with them. Can you just go over briefly the process of how a company goes from privately held to publicly traded? What is, speaking of, we brought up the SEC earlier and how that all works. If we could just go over briefly, so one day you're private and 6 months later you're public. What's the process in between there?
Yeah. So, usually you have a group of people who found the company and they will go raise venture capital. There'll usually be different rounds of venture capital. What we've seen is that process could easily last 10 years. That's been the case with Airbnb. It was the case with Facebook. Snowflake. So usually there's a big period of time when a company is private. They want to demonstrate that there's a big huge market opportunity, multi-billion dollar market opportunity. They're growing fast, usually 30%, and they're at least headed, for 100 million in revenue. And there's some semblance that they're going to get to profitability or at least cash flow positive at some point. If they meet that criteria, they will then go to bankers, Wall Street bankers. And then these bankers will do their due diligence. And then they will put together an S-1, which is the prospectus. And you can find that on EDGAR, SEC.gov. And that'll tell you everything you need to know about a company and then some. And it can be kind of scary because it has all these risk factors and these risk factors can go on and on and on. But if you're an investor in IPOs, you definitely have to read the S-1. And then the company will go through a roadshow. And there's something called retailroadshow.com. You can actually get the videos of the roadshows if you want to see them. I, if you're investing in IPOs, I would encourage that. You can see the CEO, the CFO talk about the company and why you should invest in it. The roadshow usually lasts 2 weeks and usually it's in the United States and the key cities like New York, LA, San Francisco. They may do some international. The roadshows are different now because of COVID. Now it's all done like we're doing right here on Zoom. Yeah. They will then, as indications of interest for the IPO start to come in, they'll get a sense of where the pricing should be. So the bankers will set a price range and a number of shares to sell. And then that may increase or decrease by the time the IPO hits. And then the night before the IPO hits, the management and the bankers will get together and decide on the IPO price and how many shares to sell. And that could be a contentious process. Company wants to get the high price and the bankers want to get the low price for their investors.
Of course.
Right?
So, hopefully and then in the middle.
Exactly. So there's usually some compromise that goes on. And then the next day it starts trading on NASDAQ and New York Stock Exchange. There is a new process called a direct listing. And the bankers don't go on a roadshow usually. Or it's not the traditional roadshow because they're not getting indications of interest, but they may have a video or something. And then the direct listing means the company does not raise any money. The insiders will sell shares directly to the public. And the feeling is with the direct listing, it's a fairer process because you may not get the big pop on the first day.
Sure, but I assume they're cutting out a large number of fees from these banks as well.
Yeah, yeah. Although I don't cry for the banks; they're still making millions of dollars. These banks are brought on as advisors and you still need distribution. Now, a company like Slack has a big user base that helps, but you still need some infrastructure in place and you can't completely cut out the bankers.
For sure. Yeah. And if anyone's interested in that retail roadshow video for Airbnb, we will post it in the show notes for this episode. Thanks for the tip on that. Speaking of Airbnb, it's our subject of the episode. Why go public now? It was just, you know, 6 months ago that they had lost a lot of revenue. In fact, their valuation was nearly half what it was. In March, their valuation was about half of what they're claiming it is now. Mm-hmm. So do you think this is a good time for Airbnb to go public?
I think it's probably the best time you could ever have for any company to go public right now. Like I said, I've been in this business for a long time. We got rock bottom interest rates. You know, there's not a lot of good alternative investments or growth investments for investors. And, you know, the performance for IPOs has been standout. And, you know, the IPO fund is up over 100% this year. So, you know, the returns have been off the charts. So, you know, there are these things called windows in IPOs. These windows open up and they close. The window is way open.
Wide open right now.
Wide open.
It's a door now.
It's a door. And yeah, it's huge. And it's probably going to, that momentum is probably going to continue into next year. We'll probably see some exciting IPOs next year as well. So I think the timing is spot on to go public right now. So I, you know, go on while the iron's hot, definitely.
Great. So just the other day, Airbnb planned a kind of a full valuation at $35 billion. It sounds like they raised a couple rounds when COVID first struck at $18 billion valuation. Mm-hmm. Do you see in their financials the reason to justify the much higher amount just so much soon later?
Well, they're on the roadshow right now. So they are talking to investors and they're getting indications of interest. And it sounds there's probably well oversubscribed for the demand. There's probably more demand, way more demand than there is shares available to issue. So those bankers know, they have a good sense of where the market is. And we've seen this with DoorDash too. I mean, they got funding, I think, in the summer at half the valuation where it looks like it'll come out next week. So it's as simple as supply and demand. Sure. You have a certain number of shares and a certain number of people, and they're willing to pay up for this deal.
Look no further than Tesla in that case.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. So
So Airbnb's S1 revealed that they actually had a profit in Q3 2020, which is really rare in these tech companies that are about to go for IPO. Do you see them continuing to have a profit, or is that just kind of an anomaly of what's going on right now? What do you think?
Well, they had a profit primarily because they cut a lot of staff early this year. I think about 25% of their staff. And then they cut different programs, more non-core programs. So they took a lot of costs out of the infrastructure. And then I suspect, you know, next year could be profitable just because with the vaccines coming out and things getting back to normal, you probably could see some nice revenue gains. So with a fairly stable cost structure and revenue starting to trend up, seems like a recipe for profitability. Now, the temptation for them will be to, you know, how these companies are. They like to spend and grow and, you know, try new things. So I don't know if that'll last a long time, but, you know, I could see next year being profitable.
Sure. You get a huge influx of cash and then it's like, okay, what can we spend it on now?
Exactly. Exactly.
All right. So do you think we had mentioned, you know, usually on the first day of an IPO, the price soars, and I would think that's definitely the case with Airbnb. They have the name brand equity. You know, anytime you're talking about staying somewhere outside of a hotel, it's just Airbnb. Just like you grab a car, it could be a Lyft, but you're probably calling it an Uber.
That's right.
So things like that. There's huge buzz around it. Is it potentially setting someone up for disaster if they buy on day one? If they bought at this huge inflated price, could maybe soon after it's a kind of a pump and dump situation because of all the hype around it? Is that something to be worried about in this case?
Hey, you know, my recommendation with IPOs, it's your speculation money. It's not your, you know, money that you'll need next week or next year or maybe three years from now. You know, it's money you can afford to lose. So should you be afraid? Absolutely. With any of these companies, I mean, we saw what happened earlier this year. The valuation got cut heavily. The company was on the verge of, you know, implosion. You know, the future is unknown and, you know, so you can't be guaranteed of anything when it comes to investing. That's why I think if you are going to buy some of these shares, just keep in mind, it's probably gonna be volatile and, you know, it shouldn't be, you know, your nest egg. You know, I mean, I've seen examples of this in the past where just people go, go all in and they put all their money into a few of these stocks, and then they, you know, they come back to earth and they've lost a lot of money. So I would just be cautious.
Well, hopefully our bosses who have listened to the show know better than to do that. We preach diversity here. So do not put everything you own into one IPO. Right. Really quickly, I kind of noticed it on the Airbnb's S-1 filing. They talk a lot about hosts. It's very much about hosts and not so much about the people actually staying in these places. Is there a reason why they're focused more on their hosts than the actual people paying to be in these Airbnb locations?
Well, that's a good question. You know, one of the things you can do with an S-1 is just do a search, you know, keyword search. You know, like I put artificial intelligence, I don't really see a lot in there about it. you know, the hosts are, you know, it's a two-sided marketplace. I mean, you have buyers, you have sellers, you know, or suppliers. And I think they got into some trouble earlier this year when they provided the refunds to customers and it came at the expense of the hosts.
Sure.
So, you know, maybe they're trying to make up a little bit for that, to be a little bit more host friendly. I mean, they're clearly customer friendly. But you know, I think the hosts are kind of the weak link. Yeah. I don't think it's a consumer question. Cause I think like you said, top of mind, consumers know what this is all about. That's what they think about when they do something like this. So, you know, the hosts, but you know, there's some concerns that the hosts would go and create their own, systems or go to another one.
Right.
So, you know, maybe a little bit more defensive action, but I wouldn't know though. Yeah.
Sounds good. Let's start off kind of with some of the pros and the cons of Airbnb's business model. First, the pros, obviously, you know, they have 7.4 million active listings, I think right now. Mm-hmm. And they don't own one piece of property, which is amazing.
Yeah.
And they have the name brand equity, like we mentioned. You know, the top of mind name is Airbnb. They have a non-hotel experience. You know, you can feel like you're in an actual home instead of kind of stuffed in a hotel room. And they don't need a large marketing budget. They said earlier this year, 91% of traffic came directly from people going to the site or non-paid search. What else do you see that is a pro for Airbnb? Why Airbnb, I guess?
Yeah.
Simple as that.
Right. Well, you know, marketplaces are extremely difficult to create. And once a marketplace gets critical mass, it's difficult to take it out. I mean, look at Craigslist. I mean, it's basically a marketplace. Mm-hmm. It looks like it did when I was programming in 1996.
I don't think one person has programmed one piece of code on that site in 20
years. Since then, that's exactly right. And you know what? It's still dominant.
Sure.
You know, eBay, I mean, it's slowed, but you know, when it comes to auctions, people think of eBay.
I actually just bought something off eBay last week.
Exactly. It's still a very big property. Alibaba, dominates China. So whenever you have the marketplace that becomes the dominant position, it usually is multiples more powerful than anyone else. And that barrier to entry or that moat continues for the long term. And then if there's continued growth in travel and tourism, which there will be, and people will, you know, learn more about this alternative, it's only going to benefit, you know, there's going to be an outsized benefit for Airbnb. So that advantage just multiplies over time. So they're just in a great competitive position, and you get the network effects too, you know, so.
For sure. I think you're seeing a lot of older people kind of discovering Airbnb now. And it's a part of the sharing economy. I mean, 10 years ago, if you said, do you want to stay in someone's bedroom that you've never met before? I would have said, you are crazy. I am not doing that. But now it's no big deal. And I think a lot of people feel that way.
Yeah. So I think just like a lot of these digital businesses, you know, just as time goes by, adoption is going to increase because people, I mean, I'll give you an example. My mom, because of COVID, I had to set her up with an online bank account.
Okay.
she doesn't go to the bank anymore and she never will.
Yeah.
I mean,
I haven't been in the bank in 2 years. It's about an hour drive for me. And I'm like, no, I'm good.
But I thought the last person in the world to use online banking would be my mom, because she does not want, she fears that if her money is online,
could
which
just
it
disappear.
Already is. That's exactly right. It'll just be deleted somehow by the Russians. So,
yeah.
I think there, COVID is, you know, made this huge transition, but yeah, over long-term, you know, the move to digital transformation is unstoppable.
For sure. All good signs that Airbnb is in a good position.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the opposite side of the coin. Some risk, kind of cons to Airbnb's business model. What do you see there?
Well, we talked about the hosts. That's always a concern. Yeah, I mean, the other concern is just regulation. The hotel lobbies are very powerful.
Sure.
And there's a lot of communities that feel that, you know, it's not good for the environment, you know, I don't know, the community itself or city to have people rent out their places. And then you've seen some of the horror stories. I mean, literal horror stories. You know, I think there's, you know, a murder or multiple murders at one of these big parties that were occurring at some of these Airbnb locations.
Right.
And then there's just liability issues too. As these, you know, more and more of this becomes adopted, and if, you know, nefarious activities occur in these venues, then, you know, that could be a financial problem, but also a reputational problem that damages the brand. Now, I think they've done a lot to deal with that, and I think management's been pretty good. But I think those are the main risks, but I think those are all manageable risks.
Definitely. I know in my lease that I have signed right now, there actually is a no Airbnb clause. I live in a very travel friendly location of Los Angeles, and mm-hmm. I would love to rent out my place. I'm about 30 steps to the beach, and that would go for a nice premium as I travel a lot, but I'm not allowed to do that.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people are in that same situation because of the perceived problems of Airbnb, which I think it gets a bad rap.
Yeah.
A lot of times it's not an issue, but you know, when someone's on vacation, they're in a different mode, I guess, than the normal everyday life.
That's right. That's
Do you true. See, I don't know a lot about it, but I feel like I started to see some of these larger hotel groups kind of running their own Airbnb style type rooms and locations. Is that something to be concerned of?
Probably a little bit, but you know, the other thing to think about too, is the market is huge. There'll be different options for people. It won't just be solely Airbnb. But it's hard to imagine a hotel group being able to take on and dominate the market. I just think Airbnb just has a huge advantage with their brand and their platform and their data. I mean, that's the other thing too. You know, another advantage is that they're sitting on a lot of data, and you know, as they start using more artificial intelligence and machine learning, that's going to be a competitive advantage for the company too. So I don't think that those groups would be, you know, a huge threat for the company going forward.
Yeah. Okay. And how about expansion? I know mm-hmm. recently, a few years ago, they started doing the Airbnb experiences.
Yeah.
I've actually done some of them, and a lot of them are mm-hmm. really great. Especially mm-hmm. if you're traveling solo and you want to meet some new people. I've had some really cool experiences with that. Is that a profitable business for them? Is that a path to further growth, or is there anything else kind of down the line that you could see Airbnb growing into to expand the business?
I think with COVID that may have been pulled back to some extent, and they went more digital with the experiences too. And that actually became a highly successful, high margin business for them. So that was something that was a positive that came out of COVID. With the profitability, access to capital, their IPO, the company will be in a position to do acquisitions. They'll, you know, be able to do, you know, build new systems. And, you know, after we get through the COVID situation, I think they'll be in a position to really be in the growth mode. You know, they haven't been for the last 9 months, but they will be. And I think there's so many different opportunities for them. Like you said, the experiences and, you know, to really go beyond with, you know, just matching people.
For sure. And I know there's so much pent up demand to travel. Everyone wants to
get out
as soon as possible.
Yeah.
If you don't mind, if we could take a few minutes to go over some questions from our Patreon group. These are a lot of listeners that specifically want to ask questions to you regarding Airbnb.
Sure.
So first off, Mikhail Henry asks, your favorite IPO, Snow. he said, looking at how crazy that one went, is there a max price point per share of Airbnb that you would recommend as an entry point? Is there a limit to saying, once it gets to this point, you should definitely stay away? Or what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, if you went by that rule this year, it would have been a losing rule. we're in a momentum market right now, and prices just keep going up. But the way I look at it is more this way. If I have a position that's gone up a lot, I'll usually at least take back or get a good chunk of my initial investment so I can, you know, play with the house money at that point.
Great advice. I just put in a sell order to cover one of my investments 5 minutes before we talked. Okay. Yeah. So ride that profit train. Is
what yeah. Yeah. So at least you feel like it wasn't a total disaster if things go against you. That's how I usually play that. Yeah.
So if you're not interested in the IPO game, are there any already established or speculative stocks that you could recommend that are Airbnb competitors or at least similar to the travel industry that maybe someone should look at?
You know, there's no direct competitor in the publicly traded markets. So that's another advantage you have with this IPO. You get a pure play. I mean, you could buy the Marriott's, but, you know, and actually that may be good because the travel is going to come back. And you'll probably get some exposure to some of what they're doing with their own rentals business. But there's Expedia too. I think they have a thriving marketplace. They made some acquisitions. So Expedia could be another sure. company to look at.
I think booking.com is one as well.
Yeah. I think the online players have some, usually they have some level of, Airbnb type system that they've put together in the past few years.
Sure. And just to be clear, we're not recommending these stocks necessarily, just some ideas to check out. Matt Spinnikin asks, we kind of touched on this already, but why is Airbnb not profitable? Seems like it should be a very profitable model. We said this quarter they were profitable, but that was an anomaly compared to the past.
Well, you know, marketplaces should be profitable. I mean, if you look at Alibaba, it's a highly profitable company, at least, cash flow positive. It's the Silicon Valley way, spend.
Sure.
I mean, it's really that simple. They were spending substantially more than they were increasing the revenues. But they showed that you can dial back the spending in the business fairly easily and get the profitability. So I think for investors who are looking at that, they think, oh, it's kind of like with Amazon. Amazon could have been profitable 18 years ago. They just decided to keep investing to dominate their market. And right. I think that's the Airbnb strategy.
And it obviously worked out for Amazon.
That's right. That's right.
Airbnb. That's right. Last one from Patreon. Charles Ma asks, what are some of the bull and bear cases for the long term, more of a 5 to 10 years out on Airbnb?
You know, I think it's more of a bull case 5 years out, just because, like I mentioned before earlier about the advantages of a marketplace. You know, the market is huge. Travel and tourism will continue to be important. It's not going away. You know, COVID knocked it off for a little while, but it's not going away long term. And, what we've seen with the Alibabas and the eBays, Craigslist, they last for a long time. So I imagine it'll be a larger company and probably a profitable company, a more consistently profitable company in 5 years from now.
Great. Thanks for that. Just a couple of things I wanted to go over before we get out of here. Let's say you've gone through all the analysis, you've checked out the S1, you went to the retail roadshow, and you really like Airbnb's case. Mm-hmm. What are some of the tips to get in as soon as possible on the IPO's day and get that price you want before it spikes up like crazy? Are there any kind of tips and tricks to kind of get in on the lowest level possible?
Well, you know, on the night before, don't put in a market order. That's for sure.
Be a little bit more than you plan on spending, most likely.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you could do the limit orders, but a lot of times it happens, it goes right past it. The way I've done it in the past is I'll just, check throughout the day. Usually there's quite a bit of range in the price in the first day. Now, sometimes it remains steady, but you can, a lot of times there's a volatility and you might be able to pick up some shares. So it's more of just, you know, you could, you know, set an alert on your phone if it, sure, if it hits a certain price, you know, see where it starts in the morning, and then maybe see, you know, okay, maybe at a 10% drop, you know, and then evaluate it at that point, or put in a, you know, limit order or something like that. You can, you know, and you don't have, it doesn't have to be in the first day either. These stocks usually, if you track a lot of these IPOs, there's usually a lot of variance. So you can usually pick up, yeah, you know, look at, you know, Palantir, mm-hmm, you know, had a flat opening for a while and then goes crazy. And then yesterday it just drops, you know, like a rock. And then today it's back up. So right. You see a lot of that. You see a lot of that. These stocks don't go straight up. So patience is, you know, something to keep in mind. And you can usually get a better price if you're patient. Don't just feel like you have to buy it on the first day.
Definitely. I think the biggest key is just stay glued to your screen. And if there's a max price that you'll pay, you know, stick to that. Don't
exactly
go past
right.
what you'll pay.
That's true.
Great. So to put the pressure on you, I guess, after we went over all this Airbnb, are you actually personally looking to buy Airbnb?
Well, since I do a lot of commentary on this, I try to avoid it. And there's some restrictions on it. Usually after it gets seasoned in the market, you know, I'd evaluate it. So it's a stock that I probably would be interested in buying at some point, but it's hard to, you know, until you see it start trading and what's going on, it's hard for me to know right now.
That's fair. And we want to stay friendly with the SEC.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Tom. We really appreciate it. I know our listeners have just been talking a lot about this, and that was mm-hmm. the whole purpose of doing an episode on Airbnb. We're going to talk about a couple of the other IPOs coming up as well, but Airbnb, mm-hmm. I think, is at the top of the list for our listeners. Okay. We love to travel. Our listeners love to travel. We've all used Airbnb all mm-hmm. over the world, and I think you know, we know the case for its business, and hopefully the market sees that as well.
Yeah.
Before we get out of here, where can our listeners find out more about you? Like I said, we're going to post Tom's article on our show notes. Mm-hmm. We'll post that retail roadshow he mentioned as well. Mm-hmm. Where else can listeners learn more about you, Tom?
I do have a website. You know, you can at taulli.com. It's my last name.com. And I have my bio. I have my books. I have some articles that I post there. I do write a lot for Forbes.com. So if you put my name in Forbes.com, you'll see the articles I write. I write a lot about pre-IPO companies, so those companies that may be tomorrow's IPOs. I'll give you examples. C3.ai, which is going public next week, a hot AI company you may want to keep on your radar screen. Tom Siebel is the founder there. Over the past few years through Forbes, I've been able to talk to him. So I have articles about, you know, my interviews with Tom Siebel. So, I try to stay as active as I can, and it's never a dull moment when it comes to IPOs. And feel free to contact me if you want to.
Great. Thank you so much for your time. You can also check him out on Twitter. It's at TTAULLI. That's his first initial and last name. Tom, thank you so much for your time on Invest Like a Boss. We really appreciate it. Looking forward to following you up and hopefully having some profits on this IPO.
Sounds great.
Thanks, Tom.
Cha-ching. That is a sound I think is going to be happening a lot when Airbnb IPOs.
Yeah, I see this thing taking off like a rocket. I'm going to be glued to my screen most of the day, I think, and see if I can jump in at a point that seems, let's say, reasonable.
Okay, so it looks like it's going to open around the $50 mark. What do you think reasonable would be?
So my plan, I'm thinking about a 10% premium if I can get in right in the morning.
Okay, so $55?
I'm thinking 55. If it sails past that, I'm going to be skittish about it. But like we said, like that Snowflake IPO earlier this year was over, more than 100% in one day, which is wild.
So for people who don't know what the Snowflake IPO was, they're basically a competitor, Amazon Web Services, right? Like they're like an online cloud company that most people have actually never heard of until the IPO.
Right. And Tom, he actually sounds like he's an expert in a lot of AI and cloud storage. That's his background. So he was all over that and knew pretty much what was going to happen with it. Whereas I think a lot of people, like you said, didn't even hear of this company until, you know, 2 months ago.
Yeah. And embarrassingly, I've never heard of them until very recently, but cloud storage just makes sense to me. So if you had told me 2 months ago before their IPO, like, hey, Johnny, there's this company IPOing, they're the competitor to, you know, to AWS, I would say, yeah, that sounds great. Like, let me get in on that. And I think those are actually the better investments where they don't have this hype of a kind of rabid consumer fan. So, you know, companies that are, you know, these hot growth stocks like Tesla or Airbnb is probably going to be one. A lot of it's just because there's so many users and people just love the product. And whether it's worth that price or not, people are going to overbid for it. People are going to overpay for it. You know, it's, for me, it's the same thing as Bitcoin, where it's one of these kind of hyped up so-called investments that a lot of people just like talking about, because they hear about it everywhere.
Exactly. And you can bring it up at any party and everybody knows what you're talking about when you say Airbnb. If you said, hey, I got in on the Snowflake IPO today, you might have a lot of blank faces at that party.
Yeah. So if anything, you know, a company like Snowflake to me would be more of like a value stock where it's undervalued. People had never heard of it, but it's actually worth a lot because, you know, I'm assuming they're very profitable versus Airbnb, which is, you know, it's like a hot tech stock, which doesn't make any money, but, or I guess until very recently, but it's just something that, you know, people just assume is going to be good. And who knows what's going to happen with that? Who knows if it's going to be overvalued or not? So for me, I do think that it might pop, it might spike, but at the same time, it might just come crashing down a few months after people realize, hey, this actually isn't worth as much as we bought it for.
I agree. I think my strategy going in next week, I'm going to use a very, very small amount of money and just kind of see if I can do a quick swing trade. But beyond that, I do see potential in Airbnb as a business model. I think they proved that, you know, in times of need that they can react. In the fact that they had to lay off unfortunately had to lay off a lot of staff when COVID hit, but they also figured out in a very short period of time, from March to September, how to go from losing money like crazy to actually being profitable in less than a year is super unheard of in these tech stocks. And the fact that they were able to do it that quickly, and now they're going to have investor pressure, all these regulations from the SEC that they're going to have to go through. I think it sounds like they got a pretty solid base on their hands to continue this trend. Sort of like Facebook did when Facebook first came out, they were not a profitable company and they figured it out. And, you know, I don't think they've had a losing quarter in probably the first year since they went public.
Yeah, definitely. So I think I really like Airbnb's business model. So as an investor, I actually think they could potentially be a very, very profitable company because, as you said, you know, they can pivot. And they're like, really, you think about it, there isn't that much cost of running Airbnb. It's basically a website. It's basically a online platform, very similar to eBay, where they don't have, you know, unlike Amazon, they don't need to have physical warehouses. They don't need to have fulfillment centers. Everything is literally done online. I mean, it can just be done completely virtually with as small as a staff. Yeah.
As long as you have good software developers, I mean, your hosts are doing the work. They're doing the listings. Your customers go in, they check out, you facilitate a payment process. I don't see where these crazy big expenses were coming from. I think a lot of it was just the Silicon Valley attitude of spend, spend, spend. And I think once they had to tighten the belt a little bit, that they were profitable and hopefully that continued.
I mean, that's kind of just how tech companies work is, you know, do whatever it takes to keep growing and just get a, you know, a bigger user base. And then after that, then focus on how to monetize. And for Airbnb, it's very, very easy. They have all their fees that they charge, which are actually pretty substantial. And I wouldn't be surprised if they start charging for like things like premium listings or something in the future, where they basically, you know, can make even more money by having Airbnb hosts or hotels or companies basically advertise on the listings to show up on top.
Right. I also see this huge influx of cash coming in that they're going to want to make some acquisitions. I could potentially see a VRBO or something like that getting acquired by Airbnb just to knock out the competition completely, because they're going to have a lot of free cash flow coming in here very soon.
I really hope they don't, because then that would definitely be a monopoly. Because right now there's so few, there's such limited competition. And as someone personally who has like a love-hate relationship with Airbnb, I want to see competition.
Oh, so do I. But I think a lot of times we've seen this happen before. Or just look at Amazon. If they're a competitor, they buy them. And it's just kind of how it works. Whether good or bad, it usually ends up worse for the consumer, but better for the financials of the company.
Yeah. And just so, you know, for people who don't understand why I hate Airbnb, I've been using them, you know, for more than 5, 6, 7, 8 years, pretty much since they came out. I mean, I've had it, you know, I first did my Airbnb in Canada like 10 years ago. And I've been living full time out of short term or kind of midterm housing options for the last 5+ years now. I always try to rent directly from the owner or, you know, from kind of like a local company. But often it's not a choice. I have to use Airbnb.
Sure. And same here too. I've been using Airbnb for, let's say, probably like six or seven years. And I've been on both sides of it as renting out. I've probably stayed in 7 or 8 countries with Airbnb. I honestly never have really had any major issues with it. I think I've gotten really lucky because I know some people have had very bad experiences. I've also been on the host side of it. My former boss that I worked with owned a hotel in Merida, Mexico. And although I worked in music management, supposedly a new job duty for me was to convert his hotel into an Airbnb. So it was actually a really interesting experience. And he was actually, their capacity of the, or their fill rate of the hotel went way up after they converted to an Airbnb. So that was a success story for them. And hopefully that's the case for other hosts. I can't speak more than beyond the one property that I was helping host for. But it was a positive for them. And I don't know. I have nothing but pretty positive things to say about Airbnb, but it just takes one bad stay to change all that for me too.
So I've actually been lucky where personally, I haven't actually had any bad stays. But the reason why I hate the model they have now is for long-term rentals, anything over 28 days, there is zero cancellation policy, which means if you book, you know, 3 months ahead or, you know, 4 months ahead or something, and you book for 3 months because you want to stay there kind of long term, even if you change your mind a week later, you know, a month out, 2 months out, they take 100% of that money. There's zero refunds. It's the worst long term, you know, cancellation policy I've seen anywhere. Like most people,
I think they did relax it a little bit for COVID, right?
Yeah, well, so for COVID they did, luckily, and they actually got a lot of heat for that. A lot of hosts were mad that Airbnb refunded everyone, but at the same time, those hosts are super, like, I understand that they're upset because they've, you know, lost future potential income, but what those hosts don't realize is they haven't actually provided the service yet. It's like, you know, it's like if you booked a massage and you prepaid it, but then you never got the massage, they should refund you because you never provided the service. At most, they should take like a small fee or something. And it was nice that Airbnb didn't charge that. But at the same time, like, the service was not provided. It was like, and Airbnb hosts just, I think they feel so entitled now. They're just so used to that money you're just racking in. And I really believe that Airbnb, kind of that, the host empires, a lot of them, you know, maybe have already crumbled or they're going to. Because I know so many friends who have just rented out or even bought multiple properties just to jump on that Airbnb gravy train because it was so lucrative. They can make so much money from it.
Right. I'm not gonna lie. I had looked into it for a while too, but at least in my neighborhood, I'd wanted to have one closer by. So if you're looking at anything in LA, like where I live, they've cracked down on it so hard. And in a lot of the bigger cities, in the United States, at least, have really cracked down on Airbnb, whether it's the neighbors just don't want the vacationing parties next door, or there's a shortage of housing and people are buying up empty houses just to facilitate vacationers instead of actual residents. There's a lot of legislation kind of against the Airbnb model.
Yeah, so I do think that's one of their kind of big threats, is the legality of Airbnb going in the future. But at the same time, Airbnb as kind of a marketplace, it sucks when they lose a city like Los Angeles, but it actually doesn't affect them as, you know, that much, because they're not a localized business. They can just start focusing on another country and say, all right, well, I guess the US isn't very Airbnb friendly. Let's focus on Europe or on Asia.
Right. And there's so many places to travel that I don't know that there's many other companies that could have expanded worldwide as quickly as Airbnb did. And I think there's still a lot of room to grow in that, especially when COVID is over, because so many people are pent up. They just want to go anywhere. If it's full, they'll go to the next city. It doesn't matter. They just want to get out of the city that they're in right now.
Yeah. So I don't know. I can rant about Airbnb all day. I'm definitely like a super user, because I've been staying with them kind of full time. They're kind of like my livelihood for the last couple of years. I think most people, just as a casual user, it's a fantastic platform. And even as someone who, you know, has this love hate relationship, I'm so glad they're around, because in some countries, in some cities, there is no other option. So I am glad Airbnb is there. And I do think that in the future, what's going to happen is there's going to be so many more hosts coming on that they're going to be forced to be more competitive, both with the pricing and also with things like cancellation policies. So that's why I think Airbnb right now is focused so much on trying to make hosts happy, because in the beginning, they really focused on making customers happy. And it's a balance where right now they're trying to grow their number of listings and number of hosts. And I guarantee what's going to happen is at some point they're going to kind of flip back and say, okay, screw these guys now. We have enough hosts. They're kind of like, you know, it's like we have enough Uber drivers. We don't have, you know, we can cut their pay. We don't really care about them that much anymore. Now let's focus on the customers.
Right. I can see that happening. Host percentages going down. Like I mentioned in the interview too, if you look at their series one, and that's available to anyone that wants to access that, in case you're not aware, you can do a keyword search. And I think host was, if not the most, referred to word in the series one, it was one of the top five. So they're really focused on their hosts, because those are their bread and butter, to have these properties. And it's really interesting to see that. But like you said, I could see it happening 2 years from now. They go, oh, well, we got all these people hooked and they got some nice cash flow. Well, now we're going to bang them with more fees.
Yeah, 100%. So as far as investment wise, would you actually invest in the IPO?
So like I said, I think my play is I'm going to try the IPO play very short term. Just take a quick profit, if hopefully it happens, knock on wood, don't have any wood nearby. But beyond that, I definitely think Airbnb is a good play for the long term, but you need to let the IPO sort itself out and stabilize more. This is the kind of thing that it's going to swing a lot in the first few months. And then I think you're going to see that lockup period drop a lot too. Cause speaking from where I am here in Venice Beach, this is the home of Snapchat, where Snapchat was started. And I remember the night that the IPO hit, every bar around was just packed full of instant millionaires. You know, a lot of guys that didn't have money before are all of a sudden millionaires. And once that and they go out and they buy the Lamborghini, or they buy the Mercedes, and they buy the nice house, and then they realize they got to pay for it. So once that lockup period expires, they dump all the shares they can, because they went crazy on all this new money that they had. So I think that's definitely going to be the case with Airbnb, because it's been a 10-year run-up. So there's a lot of people that have pieces of this company that are going to, you know, make a lot of money next week, but they can't touch it for, you know, six to nine months, whatever the lockup period is. I should look that up. I don't know it offhand. But I think you're going to see, after that expires, the stock will stabilize more, and it's definitely something worth looking into.
Yeah, and that's actually a good strategy. I think I would do something very similar. I would put in some kind of buy limit order at maybe like $60 or something, and then I would sell set a sell order just before that lockup period, you know, maybe a month before or something to cash out and see if it drops. The only problem is I have no idea how to even buy shares of Airbnb right now. I logged into my SHOB account, and when I try to pull up the ticker symbol, I see nothing.
So it won't show up until, as long, assuming it doesn't change, it will be, let me get the correct date so I don't screw it up. Tom told me a cool site called ipocalendar.com, and it looks like on Wednesday, the ticker symbol will be listed, and then you should be able to find it in your SHOB account then, but it will not be traded until Thursday. And that would be Thursday, the 10th of December.
Okay. So let's see what happens. I would be excited to actually throw, you know, some play money, you know, $1,000 just to see how it goes. But this is not my strategy. I'm not a IPO gambling kind of guy. That's why I don't own any shares of Tesla, even though I like them as a company. But it is interesting to watch and kind of just see what it's like to be part of an IPO, because I think it is exciting and it is something to talk about.
Yeah, our speculative guy, Sam, is not on today. He just posted an article about Tesla. He's all about Tesla. He's very excited about his Tesla stock. I don't own any stock in Tesla. I do like the speculative stuff. It's fun. But I've been finding myself being a lot more conservative lately, especially with this crazy market. I'm sitting on a lot of cash right now, just moving it into some more of the yielding bond stuff that we've talked about. And I don't know what to buy. Everything looks expensive. So I think this IPO looks fun to use some play money with and potentially get a nice run up. Although every time I think something's too expensive, it just goes higher in this market.
Well, everything is going crazy right now. So I'm excited to be talking to Sam on the Q4 update, the end of the year update for 2020, to review all of our investments and see where we ended up. If we're up or down, what went up, what went down, what we bought, what we sold. That's going to be a Patreon exclusive, like all the quarterly updates have been for the past couple months. Thank you guys, Patreons, for supporting the show, because without you guys, we wouldn't have Derek on the team and we would only be doing one podcast a month, because Sam and I both have kind of gotten busy with other things. But because of you guys, because of the Patreons, we're able to do, you know, 3-4 episodes a month like normal. And these quarterly updates allow Sam and I to both be way more transparent than both of us were willing to be completely publicly. So if you want to support the show and see that Q4 update coming out soon, go to investlikeaboss.com, click on Patreon, and you can sign up for as little as $5 a month, and you can get benefits like watching all the quarterly updates, as well as our buy and sell notifications as it happens.
Definitely. And you can suggest guests in there. I always follow up anybody that suggests guests in there, and early access to a lot of content, especially like timely stuff like this. You know, we'd like to provide all that stuff first to our Patreon members. Just another benefit of signing up.
Yeah, definitely. And actually, this last month, we got a ton of new Patreons signed up. James Martin, Ben K, Robert MC, Guy, Matthew, Charles H, Nicholas E, Jacob Clark, Pete, Jacob Hohen, Joe Wine, Megan T, and Noah D. Thank all of you for signing up as Patreons, and for everyone who has continued to support the show for so many months, actually maybe even coming up on a year now. So big thank you to you guys.
Totally awesome. Thank you to all those new Patreons, and of course the ones that have been around the whole time. Also, make sure to do a 5-star review on iTunes. That helps us bump up in the listings. We've got a nice little run. We hit our 400. I promised to get someone a slushy for number 400. I don't know who it is, but anyone who comes to Venice Beach and finds me, you got a slushy. Show me your review though. A couple new ones coming in. I'll read them quick. Kid Plug said, "Great investing insights. This is my new favorite podcast. Johnny and Sam are excellent hosts, and they share a ton," in all capital letters, "of info and advice." Thank you for that. One more quick. Eggboy99, "I listen to these guys every day at work, and they have helped me inspire They have helped inspire me to start my own business. I enjoy learning with them, and the guests they bring to the show bring an incredible amount of value and knowledge. Good luck with your new business, Eggboy99. Thanks, guys. It's super hard to leave reviews now on iTunes, but if you can, go search Invest Like a Boss, and it's all the way at the bottom. You got to scroll. But we really appreciate it if you take the effort to leave a 5-star review.
Yeah, definitely. It helps keep us in the rankings as one of the top investment podcasts. And we really believe that we are one of the only investment podcasts where, first, we actually put our money where our mouths are. We invest our own money. And second, we aren't like, we're not, I don't even know what the word is. We're not tied to any industry. I mean, there's some investment podcasts that are just like, real estate's the only way to go. You know, the stock market's terrible. And the other ones are like, why would you waste your time, you know, with real estate? You know, index funds are the only thing, or, you know, obviously there's shows that are like crypto, 100% Bitcoin. We are unbiased and we want to talk about everything. So really, Invest Like a Boss is the podcast about investing that I wish existed when I first got into this. And that's why Sam and I started the show. And that's why hopefully Derek is part of the team now. You know, what did you like about Invest Like a Boss when you first started listening?
The same thing. I mean, in the last year, we've talked about $1 houses that you can buy. We've talked about wine. We talked about strip clubs, ski rentals, and then even supposedly boring stuff like bonds and, you know, real estate, the old standbys. And then we've had people like John McAfee. It's all over the board. And I think that's what people love about it. And that's what drew me to the show myself, that, you know, you guys are real and you do put your own money up, and I'm putting my own money into a lot of this stuff too. And it's worked out for me personally. I had the best financial year of my life this year. And I'd like to attribute a lot of that to what I've learned from you guys and taking your strategies and just going from there. And I think a lot of people, if they take the time to really learn about these things and get interested in it, then it helps everything in your financial life.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And, you know, in this day and age, with diversification being as easy as a couple of clicks, you know, there's no reason to be 100% to anything anymore. There's no reason to be 100% index funds, 100% real estate. The diversification is the name of the game of this century. So guys and gals, thank you so much for listening. Thanks for sharing this podcast with your friends. Fun fact, if you listen on Spotify, you can actually take a look to see what your most listened to podcast was of the year. So if it was Invest Like a Boss, please share it on your Instagram, on your Twitter, on your Facebook, and tag us at Invest Like a Boss. We'll see all of you guys next week for the DoorDash IPO, which I'm sure a lot of people are going to be excited about as well.
Thanks for listening to the Invest Like a Boss podcast. Join our mailing list at investlikeaboss.com to get exclusive access to our insider investment portfolios and our private members forum.
If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Tell your friends and leave us a review in the iTunes store. It helps more than you know. See you guys next week.